remember that we left off in the eighth circle. Ron pointed out in the last lecture that, in fact, there are two circles of fraud, circles 8 and 9. We're in what's called the area of simple fraud, as opposed to compound fraud. Compound fraud, the ninth circle, we'll be dealing with that in the next lecture, is fraud perpetrated against those for whom there's a special bond of trust. And so we're going to remain now in the eighth circle where we have this simple fraud. And we've already seen that wonderful event where Dante sort of gets God's justice in his conversation with Nicholas III. We've got to tell you, it's a rocky road. Even when Dante makes progress, it's not automatically all downhill, literally or any other way, from here on. For example, in the very next canto, where Dante encounters the fortune tellers, their punishment involves such twisted bodies, or shades, technically, that Dante starts weeping. And Virgil really lets him have it and says, you know, stop that. This is not a place for that. Dante has been a backslider in a certain way. It reminds us that although Dante in some ways is sort of over a particular intellectual hump when he has this encounter with Nicholas III, it's by no means automatic. It's not a habit yet. And we're going to see a lot of backsliding on Dante's part. He's still got a lot to learn. We still have four-fifths of the poem to go. We're going to focus now, for the rest of this lecture, in a particular ditch of this eighth circle where, unusually for the Divine Comedy, Dante and Virgil have two totally different conversations in the same place with different people. And so it's going to be a way where we're going to have two very different looks at the same sin, which will allow us to stop at the end and say, what exactly is the nature of this sin? It doesn't have as obvious a label, as obvious a name as simony or pandering or seducing or flattering or fortune-telling or whatever. So we're going to be looking at cantos 26 and 27, Virgil primarily chatting with Ulysses, and then Dante chatting with a more or less contemporary Italian named Guido da Montefeltro.
Whatever the sin is called, it's a sin of misdirected intellect, and the two figures represent that, as Bill says, with an ancient model, Ulysses, and the more modern model. Let's talk a little bit about Ulysses first. Dante certainly knew about Ulysses, but he only knew about Ulysses from the Latin sources, not originally from the Greek. So that, for example, the heroic Odysseus, the hero of Homer's great epic, Dante doesn't know about him firsthand, only in summaries that had been handed down to him in Latin translation. But he knew the role that Odysseus, now become Ulysses, had in Virgil's Aeneid. And basically, his role there was to be resident slimeball among the Greeks. And in fact, one of the things that's very interesting about Dante's portrayal of Ulysses here is that he starts out taking the Ulysses that is present in the Aeneid, giving us a picture of that guy, but then extending the story, that is to say, Dante's own creation becomes part of this canto, where he takes what's known and adds to it his own version of the story. And he starts, turns out that they have a really interesting punishment, these sinners. They are encased in tongues of flame, all right, that they're sort of inside flames. And when Virgil and Dante encounter this sort of split flame, we find out that it has inside it Ulysses and his buddy Diomede, that is to say, the guy who was his buddy in perpetrating all kinds of fraudulent things in Virgil's Aeneid. So essentially what you get is that Ulysses, all right? He said, within, Ulysses and Diomede are suffering in anger with each other. Just vengeance makes them march together now. Another one of those pairs that Dante the poet seems to be so interested in. We had Francesca and Paolo. We had Farinata and Cavalcanti. Now we have Ulysses and Diomede. And he says, all right, there they lament inside one flame the ambush of the horse, become the gateway that allowed the Romans' noble seed to issue forth. In other words, that's a reference to Aeneid Book 2, which we spoke of earlier, the fall of Troy, Ulysses was the great engineer of the Trojan horse. He was the one who's responsible for that stratagem, and for that, he's being punished now. And also being punished for the theft of the Palladium. Again, Book 2 of the Aeneid steals a statue of Minerva. Again, it's a kind of sacrilege in Virgil's poem. That's what he's here for. But it turns out that what he did in the past becomes somewhat less significant to Dante than what happened after that in a story that he tells to Virgil about what happens after he gets back from the Trojan War.
Remember how the story basically goes. 10 years in the Trojan War, 10 years getting back to Ithaca, where he's from, where he's left dad, his wife, and a son. And so you may recall, if you've done the Homeric version, this great homecoming scene. Well, this is very much redone here. Again, as Ron pointed out, Dante had not read Homer. What we're told is, gets home, not sweetness of a son, nor reverence for an aging father, nor the debt of love I owed Penelope to make her happy, could quench deep in myself the burning wish to know the world and have experience of all man's vices, of all human worth. Gets home, hangs his hat up, and says, gosh, haven't done everything, haven't been everywhere, bye, and takes a journey. Now, you might ask, what's Dante's source for this? I don't recall this either in the Aeneid or in the Odyssey. Where does Dante get this? And as far as scholars know, and God knows they've searched a lot, Dante makes it up. That is to say, this is one of the great creative moments where Dante takes this age-old story and he adds to it and carries it out to, in fact, the death of Odysseus.
Might add that Dante's willingness to do this is one sign among many that Dante gives to his readers that I want to play with the really big boys, okay, that the unsurpassed reputation of Homer and the reality as well as the reputation of Virgil, Dante saying, okay, I'm going to add something to it myself from that story, that Trojan story that's new and that's original and that takes things in a rather different way. Notice also, by the way, that coming home to wife and to father and to son is a very good thing to do, but even more, the virtues of loyalty to family, as represented in wife and son and father, would have been pretty much what defined another hero that Dante is constantly bringing up, Aeneas himself. In other words, what we're seeing here is that the way to take a look at Ulysses, as Dante describes him, is as kind of an anti-Aeneas. Here are the qualities that he had as a hero. Ulysses is the guy who negates all of those qualities by saying that kind of loyalty, that kind of pull, that kind of tie, that doesn't count anymore. What I want to do is go out there and have experience, and experience, as he puts it, all of men's vices, all human worth. And we have to ask ourselves whether or not, in fact, experiencing human vices is a good thing to do. It seems to me that you could argue, you know, that if it's, let's say your thing is you're very interested in a drug problem and you want to deal with rehabilitation, that it makes a lot of sense to visit a lot of rehab clinics and do all that kind of stuff. It doesn't make sense to say, well, in order to understand this from the inside, I think what I will do is shoot a lot of cocaine and a lot of heroin because that way I'll be able to understand what goes on much better. That there's a kind of knowledge that it's better off for us not to have. And the most important thing, I think, that's coming out of this canto is that we have to learn how it is that we're able to make distinctions between knowledge that's worth having and worth going after and knowledge that is forbidden. Essentially, Ulysses's T-shirt reads, "No knowledge is forbidden." Okay, no such thing as forbidden knowledge. And it seems to me that that's the portrait that Dante is having Ulysses paint for himself.
It's also, ultimately, as we all know, just not in the cards to be able to experience everything. For example, this is something Augustine had to learn. I can't experience everything. Sooner or later, I have to decide what I trust and whom I trust. And of course, Ulysses trusts only his own experience. In particular, he trusts only his own sense perception. And he talks about the fact that if I can't perceive it with the senses, then I have no access to it. And I want to know everything, and so I've got to experience with my senses everything. It's another important facet as he takes off on this journey. He doesn't do it alone. It isn't that, you know, I'm going to put on my backpack and go out and learn everything. It's he fires up the old boat and the sailors who came back with him, and they all take off together. Dante says these are tired men. These are men like Ulysses, who've been away for many, many years. But he's the king, after all, of Ithaca. And so there is an enormous social consequence to this, what sounds like a kind of solitary quest for experience. And we never want to lose track of the fact that whatever happens to Ulysses happens to a lot of other folks in this journey as well.
Well, and in fact, one of the things that Ulysses is good at in Homer's version, in Virgil's version, and here in Dante's version, is giving a good speech. He's doing that to Virgil, of course, down in hell. But what he does is sort of recreate the speech that he gives to these tired old men to get them to go on the journey with him. "Brothers," he said, "through 100,000 perils have made your way to reach the west during this so brief vigil of our senses. Do not deny yourself experience of what is there beyond, behind the sun, in the world they call unpeopled." Well, by the time he finishes the speech, they're, as they say in the coaching biz, they're ready to run through a wall for him. And they do. And essentially, the pitch that he's giving to them is, hey, trust me. Well, in fact, that trust leads nowhere except to their death. And it's also interesting to see, he has this wonderful image talking about what they're doing. Okay, "we made our oars, our wings for that mad flight." Well, of course, the people who are manning the oars are these old guys that he has gotten to go along with him. So there's this sense in which the fraud that we're dealing with is the ability of somebody to persuade others to do things for you. That seems to be a large part of what Ulysses here is all about.
And notice, as Ron so well put it, he's saying to these guys, trust me. This is the guy who doesn't trust anybody. This is the guy who says, I've got to do it all, see it all, touch it all, smell it all myself. This is the guy who won't buy anybody else's version, but he's saying to them, trust me. Again, what a wonderful way of thinking about what fraud is. Here's a guy that says, trust me, I don't trust anything.
And what's sort of interesting is that the symbol for going beyond the limits of already understood knowledge was to go outside of the Straits of Gibraltar, and they sail out there. Now, we mentioned in an earlier lecture that nobody in Dante's time thought the earth was flat. Only people who really thought the earth was flat were the people who made up the history books in the 1950s. Okay? They knew the earth was round. But what they weren't quite sure of was the exact size, and they tended to get it a little bit smaller. And because of that, and of course this relates to Columbus a little bit later on, they didn't believe that there was a large landmass between what they knew where they were and the east. So, you know, Columbus, he tried to make the voyage to the east, ran into the Americas instead. Ulysses, he gets out there, and what he runs into is the most wonderful, one of the most wonderful of Dante's own creations, Mount Purgatory, which is, in fact, what we're going to be talking about when we deal with Purgatory in subsequent lectures. He gets there. From a distance, he sees it, and all of a sudden, the ship sinks. What's important, of course, is that he leads himself and his men to death. But also, it turns out that this is a kind of nifty image for the fact that Ulysses is a kind of model for Dante's pilgrimage. And it tells us that what Dante is doing the right way, with Virgil as his guide, remember what Bill said about Ulysses' do-it-myself attitude, what Dante gets to with the guidance of Virgil and the help that comes to him ultimately from above, Ulysses, trying to do on his own, doesn't get to. Sees the mountain, falls, dies, But, of course, in the process, leads a lot of other people to death with him. Three times in a churning waters, the fourth blast raised the stern up high and sent the bow down deep as pleased in others' will. And then the sea was closed again upon us. And we see the ending of Ulysses and his men.
In the next canto, again, Dante and Virgil stay in the same place, in the same Bolgia, and therefore they meet up another sinner punished the same way, that is to say, encased in a flame. But it's a very different conversation. Virgil really does the talking with Ulysses. Now, Dante will do the talking with, again, roughly an older contemporary, Guido da Montefeltro, who's been dead a very short time in 1300. And therefore, if we don't have a label right away for what exactly the specific sin of Ulysses is within that category of fraud, perhaps we'll be able to figure out what the nature of this is by looking at another example of it and sort of playing the oldest game in the world. Take two different stories and see what they have in common. What is it that's going to link these two very different stories in terms of the essence of what these sinners tell us about themselves? Guido da Montefeltro was a nobleman from the northern part of Italy. He was a political partisan. He was a Ghibelline leader for many years. And right at the end of his life, he decided that he would become something else. He became a member of the Franciscan order. And in fact, he gets involved in some of the political shenanigans of Pope Boniface VIII. So his story is going to relate to some of the other stories we've heard, especially, for example, the story of Boniface VIII by anticipation in Inferno 19. And I think we'll find this is one of the most interesting and very deep parts of the entire Inferno.
Notice also in terms of what Bill said before about what connects the two, one thing that strikes me now, just as Bill says this, is clearly Guido's story is implicated in all of the events of Dante's own life, since it deals with Boniface VIII and all the political stuff that clearly results in Dante's own exile. So what you have is a story that is obviously related to Dante and therefore has a kind of direct relevance and a direct message for him. But it's important to point out that exactly the same thing is true with the Ulysses story earlier, which is to say, right, what Ulysses's tendency to do is to say, look, I have the kind of talent and ability that allows me to manipulate, that allows me to get what I want, and that creates a huge temptation which Ulysses obviously gives into quite readily. For Dante, he has to see that there's a kind of similar temptation in his journey, if you will, because, of course, for Dante, he's got to recognize that he has himself a kind of talent and ability, and the question is how to put that to use. So the story of Ulysses' journey really becomes a lightning rod for all of the concerns of Dante the Pilgrim in this broad metaphorical way, as Guido da Montefeltro's story becomes a lightning rod for Dante in this very precise and clearly specific way.
Let's take a look at how Guido introduces himself by telling a little bit of his own story. He says, I was a man of arms and then a friar, believing with the cord to make amends, and surely my belief would have come true were it not for that high priest, read Boniface, his soul be damned, who put me back among my early sins. I want to tell you why and how it happened. While I still had the form of bones and flesh my mother gave me, all my actions were not those of a lion, but of a fox. The wiles and covert paths, I knew them all, and so employed my art that rumor of me spread to the farthest limits of the earth. First of all, that's probably not true, by the way. He's a fairly important regional figure, hardly a worldwide figure. But notice he uses this image of the lion and the fox. I was tricky. I didn't win battles by, you know, being the strongest guy in the battlefield. I knew how to do all the diplomatic parts. I knew how to outfox, we would say today, my opponents. I could beat guys stronger than me because I was really, really clever. And so this is the kind of military career that Guido had. Well, then, why abandon it and become a Franciscan?
First thing I want to say is that description that Bill just gave sounds an awful lot like Ulysses. Okay. Second thing is that he abandoned it because he says, well, I saw that the time of life had come for me as it must come for every man to lower the sails and gather in the lines. Notice, by the way, that what he's doing there is saying, here we are getting close to the end. Got to sort of, you know, think about my soul now. But he uses the metaphor of life as a sea voyage, which, of course, is another neat linkage to Ulysses. But then he says, all right, things I once found pleasure in then grieved me. Repentant and confessed, I took the vows a monk takes. And then in one of the great lines that anybody speaks, I think, to Dante, and oh, to think it could have worked. Now, there are a couple of ways to take a look at that. One of them is to assume, yes, he really was repentant, and that would have worked, and he would have been saved, except that he went back to his old ways. You know, the story that he's telling is in parts here. But it seems to us, at any rate, that it makes a whole lot more sense to read this as, oh, to think it would have worked means what I was trying to do, having scammed all of these other people in my life, toward the end of my life, I was sort of trying for the ultimate biggie. I was trying to see whether or not I could scam God. Okay, and doing it by putting on the robe and the cord of a friar. Okay, so that if I wore friar's clothes, then people would think I was a holy man. But more important, I could fake out God.
Okay, I'm going to put on my Franciscan suit, and I think I'm going to have it made. But then, as it turns out, Boniface VIII was involved in a very serious military activity in the Papal States against another one of these Roman families, an enemy family of his family, the Colonna family. Remember, again, talking about all this family politics with regard to the papacy, think back to the family politics in the papacy in Inferno 19, Nicholas III and Boniface by anticipation. So he's involved in this war, and the Colonna are holed up in the city of Palestrina. If you've ever been there, it's way up on top of a mountain. It'd be a very hard place to take. And so Boniface wants to capture this city. And just having enough weapons and soldiers won't do it, largely because of where it's located. He needs a sly old fox to tell him how to take Palestrina. And so he calls on Guido de Montefeltro. That's brother Guido de Montefeltro.
Yeah. Well, brother Guido, he says that is telling us in this narrative that the problem was that I was not in the business of doing that kind of stuff anymore. Okay? He has a kind of elaborate way of saying it, but he says as follows. As Constantine, another character who recurs a lot throughout the Commedia, once had Silvestro brought from Mount Soracte to cure his leprosy, so this one sought me out as his physician to cure his burning fever caused by pride. He asked me to advise him. I was silent, for his words were drunken. All right? What Boniface wants is advice on how you zap your enemies. And Guido is saying, well, I can't give that kind of advice now. I'm not in the advice business. I'm in the friar business.
However, Boniface is not going to give up. Fear not. I tell you the sin you will commit, it is forgiven. Now you will teach me how I can level Palestrina to the ground. Mine is the power, as you cannot deny, to lock and unlock heaven. Two keys I have, those keys my predecessor, who resigned as pope, did not cherish. Okay, Boniface says then, you give me the info as to how to take this, keep in mind, city full of Christians. Palestrina's in Italy. The Colonna and all the residents are Christian. You tell me how to take that city, and you are already forgiven of the sin of telling me how to blow away fellow Christians.
Well, that's kind of a neat trick. Problem with it, of course, is that it's something that's not in Boniface's power to do. It's not in God's power to do as far as that goes, because it's a contradiction in terms. It's nonsense. It's meaningless. If you are to be forgiven, it is because you are repentant. And if you are repentant, it can't include the knowledge that I'm going to do this thing. Okay? So essentially what happens is that the way Guido tells the story, Boniface makes him an offer that he can't refuse, all right, both in terms of the terms of the offer and in terms of the office of the person who's making it. Hey, I'm Pope. I tell you what to do. And he says, I bought it. Okay? Now, he says his weighty arguments had forced me to the point that silence seemed the poorer choice. I said, Father, since you grant me absolution for the sin that I find I must fall into now, ample promise with a scant fulfillment will bring you triumph on your lofty throne. Well, first of all, nothing particularly weighty about Boniface's argument at all. The argument is arrant nonsense, but he goes for it. And he therefore tells him, here's the strategy that you use. What you do is you make a promise and you don't keep it. You promise that there's going to be a kind of truce, and then when they all come out of the fortification, you zap them. Nice guy, Guido.
Now, one thing you might think about is this guy is a Franciscan. What do Franciscans do? Well, if you go back to the founder, St. Francis of Assisi, what he did was go around and first of all, he said peace to everybody. And the second thing he did was to urge everybody to repent of their sins, to come back to God. And in fact, when the Pope approved the Franciscan order at the beginning of the 13th century, he specifically approved the friars as preachers of penance. You are to go out and call people to ask God to forgive them their sins, to come back to God. That's the friar business, if you will. And Guido is a friar. He's repented and confessed and takes on this role of friar. If anybody should know that Boniface's argument is totally bogus, not a weighty argument, it's a friar.
Now, what happens, of course, is that they use Francis to kind of continue the fate of Guido after he dies. He does what he's supposed to do. St. Francis came down to get me when I died, but one of the black cherubim cried out, don't touch him, don't cheat me of what is mine. He must come down to join my other servants for the false counsel he gave. From then to now, I have been readied his hair because one cannot be absolved unless repentant, nor can one repent and will a thing at once. The one is canceled out by the other. Think of what happens here. It's the devil who points out the logic, and more specifically, the flaw in Boniface's logic. And so you have this wonderful comic scene. One way I like to think of it is that you have the three of them sort of lined up there. Who is the best theologian? The Pope, Boniface VIII, the friar, Guido, or the devil? And it turns out that the devil wins in a slam dunk. It's kind of interesting to see what that says about the state of penance, let's say, in the church in Dante's time. It's also interesting to think about it in terms of Guido himself. Here's a guy who spends his entire career scamming others, and in what is a really obvious scam directed toward himself, he falls for it hook, line, and sinker. Very interesting, in other words, to think about the implications of that. Here's this guy who doesn't see the same thing he's been perpetrating all his life when somebody comes back and plays it against him. Again, that I think goes very deeply to Dante's sense of what sin does, that notion that we saw very early on about here are the folks who have lost the good of intellect. Seems to me that you have to look at Guido as a wonderful example of somebody who has lost the good of intellect.
Why does Dante spend so much time here? Pretty much two entire cantos, two totally different conversations. Why is this such an important place? And I think if we look at these two characters, Ulysses and Guido de Montefeltro, one of the things we realize is they're both incredibly bright, they're clever, and they're very good at the use of words. They are really people of enormous ability, the ability of leadership, as it turns out. He was a successful military guy for a lot of years, as it turns out. And if we think about that, we also realize what a talented guy Dante is. And Dante knows that. It'd be stupid for him to deny it. And therefore, what are the dangers? What are the temptations? What are the things that can happen to people who have great talents but don't have what we would call sort of the moral fiber to use them well? Simply see those talents as a way to advance their own personal agendas. And in that way, it seems to me, this is a very important place for Dante to stop, because certainly he must have been someone who felt some of those temptations that Guido and Ulysses do.
When we pick up next time, we will go here from the realm of simple fraud to what we call complex fraud, fraud against those who deserve a special trust, who have a special trust for us.